Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Sisploitation Conflagration. Here are your two amazing hosts, Nate Bradford and Stephen Ronquillo. Guys, take it away! Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 600. I can't I can't believe I've been through a podcasting that long. And I've got a great guest tonight. If you know your history about the Carolina drive-ins and stuff, you'll know who Worth Keeter is in a heartbeat. Well, if you collect public domain box sets, you would know him from Wolfman, which was basically on every public domain DVD box set.
Worth and I, we've never met, but just so you know, you're on our 600th podcast. Honored to have you here.
Yes, very honored.
The way this usually works is Stephen guides the show, and I sit over here and drink beer, do shots, and smoke marijuana, and then occasionally chime in. So that's how this works.
Yeah. Okay, well, I can deal with that.
All right. I am knowledgeable about, film and pop culture, so I can chime in and add to the conversation, but Stephen generally guides the shows.
The only film that I can remember of you and Earl on VHS was the two 3D ones that were now converted into 2D then put on VHS.
Yeah, they are, let's see, I'm trying to think. We did a number of 3D movies, and they are now in, I just forgot the name of the company. Severin Films is doing Blu-ray re-releases on a number of 3D movies.
Yeah, I know Dogs was one of them.
There was Rottweiler was the first one, which was, I think, called Dogs of Hell in release. And the second 3D we made was called Hot Air. The third was Hit the Road Running. And then there was Tales from the Third Dimension and Chain Gang and Hyperspace.
Go ahead, Nate.
Oh, I was going to say, I remember Dogs of Hell being released in 3D. I didn't remember Hot Air being a 3D movie, it was your film, so if you say
yeah,
so. I remember Tales of the Third Dimension being in 3D, and I remember Dogs of Hell being in 3D, but I guess maybe I just never saw the 3D version of Hot Air. But that's cool.
Yeah, that was our second 3D. I remember because we had aerial footage and we had difficulties with the mounts for the helicopters because of the 3D lenses.
Yeah, look at how easy it is for filmmakers nowadays to do aerial shots with drones. I think about the stuff that you guys went through making movies back then. I watched the opening sequence to The Shining, and I'm just like, holy cow, like how many hours of helicopter did that take, you know?
With the 3D cameras, too.
Yeah, the cameras, our system used a single camera, but the lens mm-hmm. was quite bulky. But even so, even the lightest cameras then were a good bit heavier than what people are shooting with now, because they were film cameras, and just by necessity, there was always a certain amount of mechanism and motors in there to make it work.
Yeah, right. And so the 3D in each of those films was done in post-production then, of course, right?
It was done in the camera.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, really? So those are in camera.
They didn't have that was an old thing, the post-production 3D. Back then, you had to shoot it with 3D cameras or lens like they did.
Because there was no digital anything that didn't exist at all. That was way before that. But the what we used regular 35mm cameras, film cameras, but the lens split the image, and it put it was an over-under system. The top of the frame would be like the left eye image, and the bottom of the frame would be the right eye image. And then when they were projected, they were recombined through polarizing filters.
Wow, that's really interesting to me. I'm a huge film fanatic, and I'm a fan.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Hello?
I think Nate, we lost Nate. But people, you see, we've had these box sets these years. It came from Florida, the William Griffey. It came from Minnesota, the Bill Rabane. If they did a Worth Keeter and Earl Owensby set, it would have to be the Mad Men from the Carolinas or something like that, because that was your two stomping ground, wasn't it?
Well, yeah. Was originally from North Carolina. So that had that portion of my career here, and then the other portion in L.A.
Yeah, I mean, back then it was like a legend. I was like, these two guys down in the Carolinas made these movies for his drive-in and cut out basically the middleman and the opening man, so he could just basically take all of his money and reinvest it into his own movies and not have to worry much about sharing profits with others.
Well, he did finance his own movies. So, at least in the beginning, they were all self-financed. So, there was Earl had really no one to answer to.
Yeah.
And, he would come up with the ideas for the movies and decide what was going to be made.
Yeah, this is back in the 70s where the theaters, you could take a chill what they want, and they didn't have to sign these contracts with studios where it was like, if you want our film A, the big blockbuster, you got to show our film B and C. And it basically knocked out the small independents.
Well, they our movies did play some of the theater chains. We just didn't have the clout. Prior to actually working on movies, I worked in a movie theater, so I was familiar with the. Back then, there really weren't many multiplexes, so But there was a bidding process where the theater chains would bid on who got the hot movie. I remember the chain I worked for, the big movie we got at the time was The Exorcist, and that was a big bid. You had to pay a lot more of your admissions to get a movie like that.
Yeah. And that's another way that you guys got in, because you could offer sweeter deals to the theaters than the majors would give you. You're like, go ahead.
There were some of the movies were distributed by larger companies. Earl's first movie, Challenge, was distributed by a company called Cinemation, and it was a national release. And then the movie Buckstone County Prison in 1978, I think, was Film Ventures distributed that nationally.
Ooh, Cinemation. I bet Earl didn't make 1 cent off that movie. If any of the stories,
I
believe, yeah. Because I've heard stories about Jerry Gross and his bookkeeping and profit-sharing method.
Yeah, well, you know what? Luckily, somewhat for Earl, he had started distributing the movie regionally before Cinemation got involved. So he had made some money on the movie before Cinemation got involved. But I believe once they got involved, the profits never found their way through.
Yeah.
Of course, that
Jerry,
was not uncommon.
Yeah, that was the way of the walk back then.
Yeah, we went through that with a number of companies over the years.
Even it's like I've always had a joke. How can you tell an independent horror exploitation classic from the 70s?
How?
The filmmakers got screwed by their distributors and never seen a penny from it.
Yep. Yep. That's there's another film that I worked on called Axe, and Severin re-released that on Blu-ray a year or so ago, and but the filmmaker Rick Friedle that made it was never even aware that the movie was being retitled and re-released constantly for
Axe, California Axe Massacre, Lisa.
Yeah, it was originally, when I worked on it, it was called Lisa. And then, God, I'm trying to remember that distributor.
Novak, Harry Novak.
Yeah, Harry Novak. And he retitled that movie over and over again.
Yeah, and he put his name on it, Harry Novak Presents. So he tried to say that, and he put a card in there, produced by Harry Novak.
Yeah, somebody recently asked me what Harry Novak was like, and I said, well, I never met him. The movie was completely finished before he ever got involved in it. He had absolutely nothing to do with the financing or production or anything having to do with that movie.
Yeah. Are you going to kill your microphone? I guess he is, because there's still no audio from him and he's there. But, yeah, I mean, I've heard stories about Harry Novak. Even Something Weird put out his movies until it come time to re-up the contract, and they said, There's no way that we're paying the fees that Novak wants, because there's no way that we would make money off of it with what he's asking us for his catalog. Mm.
Wow. Yeah, they did some when they did the re-release of Axe. There's some documentary footage they went of them looking for the negatives of the film. And by this time, it was Novak was long dead, and all these reels of film were in this dilapidated building, and they were searching through, and they eventually did find all the negatives and elements for Axe.
Yeah, I think that was in the big warehouse that something weird that Mike Barney just bought out of the blue. Friend of his called
him. Oh,
yeah. Said, hey, there's this big factory here, and it has like over 2 tons of film in it. That's
yeah, I'm
how.
I'm glad some
yeah.
people like looking for that stuff, because it's nothing that is that I'd want to be involved in. All just stacks of dusty cans and rotten
yeah.
buildings.
And you gotta hope that someone put the right film in the right can. It's like, oh look, here's Worth Keeter's film. Let's look in there. Why is a copy of Gone in 60 Seconds in this can?
Yeah, not only that, but they're never all in one place.
Yeah.
You'll find a reel somewhere, and then the others will be somewhere else.
But, yeah, I mean, that had to be a great way to learn your craft back then, is that you could just get hired on one of these small independent movies like that, and they'll be like, okay, we're going to film, we're going to do this on Saturday. But I don't have any skill. Yeah, but we need a cameraman, and you're here.
Yeah, we. I never saw that in terms of camera people. But for instance, on Axe, the location sound recordist was also the guy that composed the soundtrack for the movie. And he had come in wanting to do the soundtrack for the movie. And I guess the reasoning was, well, he records things, so he must know something about sound. And they said, well, you know, would you also record the sound on the set? And they gave him a recorder and a mic, and that's the way that happened.
I got Axe's California Axe Massacre when my video store was selling off a whole bunch of their films, and I was surprised how good that movie was.
Yeah, it the writer director Rick Friedle really to him he was making in his head he was making an art house film. And not
yeah.
a horror film. Yeah, he...
well, it plays like that.
But he knew that he had to have a genre in order to sell it. And but even though it was a very, very quick shoot, he really took a lot of care with it.
All
yeah,
right, guys, my internet's down, but I'm on the phone, so the sound quality might suffer, but I'm
good,
here.
But yeah.
And yeah, and so mentioning that, wasn't that kind of what Ed Wood's idea was behind Plan 9 from Outer Space? If you make a genre film that you can sell and make some money off of, that can finance your other, you know, your next film. Isn't
yeah.
that what a lot of artsy directors will say, one for the studio, one for me, right? You know.
Well, I think on Axe, Rick was, you can really tell that he was really inspired by the Polanski film. God, I'm missing the title of it right now.
Repulsion.
Yeah, Repulsion. Yeah, when,
it's like
yeah.
a cross between Repulsion and Last House on the Left.
But yeah, he was really influenced by Repulsion, I think. But yeah, it was to find the money for a movie, you had to tell someone how they were going to make their money back. And that was the easiest thing to point to is, look at these horror movies. They're making money. And people would just take that as a fact.
Yeah,
and that's
and...
one of the biggest reasons Earl started to make his own movies for his own drive-ins. It's like, you mean you can make my movies and don't have to tell people where and how they're going to make their money back? Okay.
Well, a couple of things. First of all, he didn't own any theaters. He didn't own any drive-ins or anything. That was there was a group in Charlotte called Preacher Man Corporation that had made a movie called Preacher Man, and they did own theaters. They did own drive-ins and so forth, but Earl did not own theaters, but he, like I say, the first, I don't know, five or six movies he produced himself, so there were no outside investors in it. It was after we made the movie Living Legend that there were some investors, and that movie was very successful for the investors. And so they just kept reinvesting in movies at that point.
Were you still in the mode of just shipping film canisters around the country, like roadshow style, just theater to theater, or did you have multiple copies that you were distributing?
There would be between on the regionally distributed movies, there would be 50 to 100 prints of the movie, and there were sub distributors that you dealt with, and they would you'd go to a certain region where all your advertising crossed over, so you'd buy out advertising in the newspapers and the radio. There was most people don't know, but prior, I think maybe to Jaws, there wasn't much television advertising for movies because it was very expensive. I think Jaws was probably one of the first movies to do that. So there wasn't television advertising, but you had newspaper and radio. So they would talk.
Oh, yeah.
I have
thousands of newspaper ads from, I mean, I'm 50 years old, so I've been collecting newspaper ads for movies my entire life. I have thousands of them that I've clipped out of the newspapers my entire life. I love the newspaper ads.
I've got quite a few CDs with the radio ads. I love it because they would make like a movie for those that you could see in your head.
Yeah.
Well, they used to, you guys are probably familiar with this, when a movie would come out, there would be the press book. And in the back of the press book would be the different movie ads. And the the manager of the theater goes up and pastes them up, and that's what went to the newspaper to be printed.
Yeah. And those little records that they sent out to radio stations, if you can find any of them, I've seen them go for a pretty penny nowadays.
Well, they used to, there was occasionally they'd have an interview record and it would be the star of the movie. There would be a script, and there would, and you would have the star of the movie on the record answering the questions. So then what would happen is it would go to the local radio station, and your local radio personality would act like he was interviewing in the station this movie star, and he would ask the question. And then
I remember that from when I was growing up. Yeah, yep. They'd have, the local DJ would just pretend like they had the actual person on the show. Yeah, I totally remember that.
I've got one. It's on the Cinema Wasteland Volume 1 radio ads. And in between every answer by John Gielgud, it would have edit and add DJ asking question here.
That's right.
It actually says that on the record.
Yeah.
It actually says it right on the sleeve.
No, on the audio recording, so they could at the station edit and know where to put the questions.
It would sound like a
seamless interview rather than him asking a question and then putting the record back on again.
Well, you know me, Stephen. I collect vinyl, and I collect all kinds of rare and weird vinyl. I've never gotten an interview record like that that actually had something like that.
Only one I've actually seen in Raw was this guy selling drive-in. I was like, "Ooh, an interview record. How much?" He's like, $200.
The manager of the theater would get all of this material with the movie. They'd get the record and they'd get the radio spots and the press book with the ads. And then they would give you ideas on how to promote the movie. And all of that was in the press book.
And for all you people who don't know, the sub-distributors, there was, the Carolinas. Tennessee was part of Tennessee, Alabama, and Mississippi. And then there was the Floridas.
Yeah.
And then there was the Texas ones, which basically covered Texas, California, Arizona, and New Mexico. And you would have to go to the major sub-distributor of that area, and he would cut you a deal, and he'd distribute your film.
That's right. That's how it worked.
Well, lost Nate again. There he is.
Nope. My internet came back up, so I called back in so I could talk on my actual microphone instead of talking on my phone.
I have seen a lot of people write about drive-ins, but none of them talk about this aspect of it. They talk about the movies and stuff and their local drive-ins, but they never get into things like that. Mostly they brag about four-walling and stuff like that.
Yeah, four-walling was, it was not real common. I mean, there were companies that, there was a company, Pacific International, that we had dealt with at one point that did these, nature movies and then they did a series called The Wilderness Family that were dramas.
Oh, that's some classic.
It was Pacific International, actually, but they were tied with Sun Classics, very similar.
Yeah.
And then there were some documentaries like Chariots of the Gods and so forth that I think were four-walled.
Oh, I know about those. We had Jefferson David, the one who worked a lot, worked on them before. May he rest in peace. But yeah,
yeah
they did
yeah.
like
you could just buy the theater out for X amount of money per week, and you owned the theater. You owned, I mean, every dollar that came in was yours. The theater had been paid. They kept the concessions, I think.
Yeah.
Huh.
The Sun's big ones were, let's see, The Mysterious Monsters, Chariot of the Gods, The Bermuda
yep.
Triangle, The Late Great Planet Earth, Chariot of the Gods, In Search of Historic
yep.
Jesus, The Assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. I know, Worth, you don't know me very well, so you don't know this about me, but I mention it all the time on the show. I'm a huge fan of cryptozoology, UFOs, the mysterious and the unknown. Those Chariots of the Gods movies and yeah, all of those films were really exciting to me as a child. And I own most of them on either Blu-ray or I have a digital version of them now. You know, I mean, I love that stuff. I love it. Yeah.
A time, you know, people are used now, you can find anything anywhere, but back then there were just a handful of television stations and anything else, if it was certain subject matter, you were not going to find it on television or anywhere else.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Stephen and I talk about this frequently here on our show, where we just mention, you know, like how much it's, of course, so much easier to find anything that you're interested in now with the internet. But, back in the day, you had to have a cool video store in your neighborhood, or you had to, go to the bookstore and buy a magazine and learn about something that might seem cool to you. You know, did they even have
yeah.
bookstores or video stores anymore? Do those things still exist?
I think there's still Barnes and Noble somewhere, but I don't know about video stores.
Yeah, I don't think there's a Barnes and Noble right in my neighborhood, but yeah, there's no video stores around here. Nah, they're all gone.
It is sad that Earl's most well-known film nowadays is Wolfman, and it really isn't one of his best, and it's not typical of his work. But because somehow if there's a print on public domain everywhere, that's the one everyone knows.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember at the time, because I was in L.A., and Earl had called me and said, yeah, that everybody's distributing this thing, and there was an address. And I actually, it was not far from where I lived, and I went to this office building, and, of course, the place was deserted. But, yeah, it was pirated, and then everyone had it.
Huh.
Yeah, you would try to track them down, but it'd be lead you to empty office building after empty office building.
Yeah.
One of the funnier stories Worth I know is that the owners, well, you know that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was directed by Bryanston Films, which is owned by the mob, the Perino brothers.
Okay.
So after the first year, the mob distributed the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So the producer,
I think you're dabbling in libel here, Stephen. I don't know.
No, it's actually true. It's even on the Blu-ray. What happened is he burst into the office, and he was like, and he just basically is like, I want my money. Where's my money? You're ripping me off. And then he looked and realized who he was with, and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, sir. May I please leave now? I didn't mean to bother you.
There's that's not an uncommon thing, or it wasn't at the time.
Not for the time. Yeah, right. So, what I wanted to ask you about, and this is something I was really excited about having you on the show for, Worth, is I was a really big fan of Silk Stockings. Can you tell me a little bit about the series or the episode or that you directed?
I was finishing a movie, and production manager, line producer on that movie had moved on to do this series with Sue Siegel and Stephen Cannell. And he recommended me as a director for the show or for an episode. And so they, Stu Siegel, the producer, he brought Stu to the editing rooms, and they looked at, you know, some scenes that we were cutting and so forth. And then a couple days later, pardon me, I got the call that they would like me to direct an episode of the series. So it was to be the second episode. They were doing a pilot that was the first episode, but
right.
Pilot only in the sense of it was the first show. I was to do the second show. And so I went down, it was being done in San Diego, and they were just getting their studio in order and building the set. So I was there as they were shooting the first episode, but none of the sets for the show were finished. So the first episode as far as I know, they didn't use any of the sets that were used for the rest of the show. It was mostly done on location. So the one show ended at like midnight on a Thursday night, and I started first thing Friday doing the second episode. And they were just, we had three sets on the first day, and none of them had been shot in before, and none were lit. So it was a very long day, but I did that show, and but there were some difficulties because the network CBS had not seen any of the footage from the first show until the night before I started shooting the second show. And they had a lot of problems with the show. And I had just started shooting, and the producer came down to the set with this whole list of things. And like, they didn't like the color of this or that. And I'm like, well, you know, what do you want me to do? I mean, we're the sets, these are the sets. This is all I have to shoot on. And so it was difficult. And so I was not back to do another episode of the series. And I learned that really was, I just sort of got caught up in this crossfire and I was the easiest guy to sacrifice, I guess.
Yeah, it does seem strange because Stephen Cannell has such a storied history with successful TV shows. And of course, he's going to bring in a host of different directors and writers to work on his shows. But yeah, I think you're probably right. They threw you under the bus because they were just like,
well,
meh.
You know, there was no problem prior, because I actually, the script that I directed was written by Steve Cannell. And
right.
And he actually flew to the studio in his private jet to be there for the table read. So when we did the table read of the show, Steve Cannell was there, and we went over every detail of the show. And he was all on board. The big issue was the production design. They decided to go with a really way out production design for the show, with a lot of really wild colors. And for instance, the police station had black walls. I mean, it was surrealistic. And every episode, you were assigned two colors, and that was your color palette for the show. And mine was magenta and turquoise. So those colors were everywhere on all of the
stuff. So people, he's
magenta.
Not colorblind. It's not his fault. That was what he was stuck with.
But where it gets back to Cannell is, when CBS looked at it, they said, that's not what we want. We want like Hunter or these other shows Cannell did that were, you know, not visually extreme. They just wanted it to look like a regular cop show and not a not like a psychedelic dream. And
yeah.
My problem was that's the way the sets were, and there was no time to change them. And so in order to get the show done, I just had to shoot on those sets and with the art direction that was put out there. So I think that's where I got in trouble.
Trouble. The thing was is that Cannell wanted to do Miami Vice, and they just wanted Hunter or a regular cop show with his much TNA as they could put in without actually putting in any TNA.
Well, yeah, that's right. But Miami Vice looked mild compared to this art direction on Silk Stockings. And by let's say the fourth show, by the fourth episode of the sixth episode, it totally looked like Hunter and those shows again. And they changed the DP. They changed a lot of people. But they kept the production designer.
And if, Nate, I got a question to ask you. Nate.
What?
Get over here. I got a question to ask you real quick.
Sorry, I was looking for something.
Yeah.
What do you got to ask me?
If you was going to do a show about books, how would you greet your co-host?
If I was going to do a show about books?
Yeah, how would you greet your co-host? What would you say to them?
I would do like one of those, just like sipping my tea.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Well, you know what I would say? I would say, hello, Vicky Love.
Hello, Steven.
Yeah. Vicky Love, our sci-fi guy.
Oh, yeah.
And you might like
Now I've got this to deal with.
Yeah, but yeah, Worth, she's a sci-fi member of the show and the well-read. If it's anything about books or anything, that's her number one.
Oh, okay.
She is good, yeah.
And, not all of them. I haven't read every book.
A minute there, yeah.
And what's funny is after you got fired after doing one episode of Silk Stockings, you got hired to another show in the 90s and ended up doing like about 300 episodes to about three or four different series of it.
Well, yeah. Now, first of all, I wasn't fired from Silk Stockings. I was only hired.
Well, you only did one episode. Yeah.
You're only hired for one episode at a time. So I just wasn't rehired to do another one. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, right. That I got a call to come meet Shooky Levy, who was a friend of mine, and I had worked on some different projects with him, and about doing a TV series, and he showed me footage of it, and it seemed pretty wild. And they said, "We want to, we're making TV and we're making TV movies, and we want to put you under contract for a year to direct for us." And I initially turned it down because I had another movie that was supposed to go. And then overnight I decided to change my mind. And but that was Power Rangers. It turned out to be the Power Rangers show.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably where I know you best from as a director, because like I said, I'm 50 years old, so that was right about in my, you know, my wheelhouse right there. That was
right.
Probably about the time, you know. Yeah. So yeah. So now I have to ask, When you were directing the episodes of Power Rangers, was that all fresh footage, or were you editing in, or were the producers editing in footage from the Japanese action shows?
Well, the way the process worked was, the producers owned the footage from the Japanese shows, and there was a certain amount of it that they would want to use, and so
right.
They would look through the editors would go through the episodes of the Japanese show and find the parts that they thought they would want to use, and then that went to the writers. And the writers would create a new story. And when we would get the scripts, if it was Japanese footage, the description would be underlined in the script. So if it was if we were going to shoot it, it was underlined. And if we weren't going to shoot it, it was underlined. And then often we did transitions, or, you know, we, you know, edited our footage with it and so forth. But as time went on, we used less and less and less of the Japanese footage. The portions we almost always used were the when the giant monsters were stepping on buildings. We didn't do the miniatures, or
right.
Rarely some of them.
And
we didn't often miniatures.
You did you guys did a great job of making it blend. There's not, you can't tell where one ends and one begins. There's no nasty jump cuts or anything like that. It does play smooth.
Well, it was sort of interesting because we had locations that were similar. like our studios were in a studio complex that was basically an industrial park. And when you got the Japanese footage, their studio looked like an industrial complex, and they would go outside and shoot. And the other thing was they had a cave, and we had a cave, Bronson Cave in Hollywood, which is famous from many movies, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, and hundreds of westerns, and it was the Bat Cave exterior in the Batman TV show. So we filmed there a lot, and our locations looked like their locations. So it made it often easy to edit the pieces together.
Yeah. And how many series did you end up working on with that many episodes? About two or three?
No, I did, let's see, I did, of the Power Rangers, I did Power Rangers, the first series. Mm-hmm. I did not do Turbo. I did Power Rangers in Space, Power Rangers Lost Galaxy, and Power Rangers Time Force, and Power Rangers Lightspeed Rescue, and Power Rangers Wild Force. So there were six Power Rangers series. And then I did VR Troopers and
I was gonna say VR Troopers. I knew you had something to do with that. Yep.
Yeah, so all in all I did nine different series for them.
Wow.
All right, Vicki, you got some questions for our guests tonight?
Well, you're
you
putting me
nerd
on the spot,
out?
Huh?
Well
I
you
want to
Power
Rangers.
Well, you.
But
go ahead.
You want to
nerd out for
them.
A minute?
I watched the Power Rangers. I just want to say that I always watch the Power Rangers with my sons, and my sons love the Power Rangers, especially my oldest son, who's now in the Navy. He loved the Power Rangers. There is nothing you could say about the Power Rangers. I'm talking about, you know, the original series and all, about the Power Rangers, that you can't say anything bad around him because he loved them. And then we saw all the movies, of course, and so, but I'm not an expert on Power Rangers. I just really like them, and I like the fact that they were done in a way that the kids really loved, because they knew it wasn't cheesy violence. It was karate chopping, but not real contact. And the kids, they loved it. They ate it up. And so the Power Rangers weren't some novel back from the 1600s. So I don't know that much about them.
I think it all came from that same era, though, where, you know, talk about like Captain Planet, I think that whole era was about like, you know, having a team of different people, you know, different races working together.
Right. Genders. It was, the bosses, you know, that they weren't just male monsters. They were females. One, you know, that one of them, I can't remember her name, but she could look kind of crazy witch-like. I can't remember her name.
Yeah, that was
Rita Repulsa.
Rita Repulsa was the main villain on the show.
Yeah.
Yes. She was fantastic. Fantastic. I can still hear it in my mind's eye.
I thought her name was Vicki Love, but I was just.
I don't have black hair.
Neither do I. Mine's gray.
Yeah, mine's turning.
Yeah.
So I wasn't really listening to the early part of the show. Sorry, don't chop my head off.
Oh, don't worry about it.
Yeah, so I can't really contribute too much yet. I just wanted to be on. It's the 600th episode.
Yeah.
600th episode, baby. We made
yeah.
it.
And I just want to thank you for all the work if you've done through the years, from your work in the Carolinas with Earl to the Power Rangers and all your stuff.
Well, thanks.
And
yeah.
you seem like you're starting to get a little worse, a little hoarse there, Worth. Would you like to call it a night?
I'm. That's just my voice. That's my
okay.
allergies. I had always had allergies. And when I lived in California for a long time, they went away.
Yeah.
And living back in North Carolina, they come back. They just come and go.
Yeah.
Man,
you,
I hear you. Sympathize, all of that. Allergies are the worst. Late summer especially, man.
So let me ask you, we've talked about the projects that you've worked on. Do you have some favorite TV shows
that's
or movies
question.
that you'd like to discuss? Because that's generally what we talk about on this show.
Well, let's see. Not I've always been a huge fan of the James Bond movies. Let's see, going back in my, I always liked this sort of spy thing, and going back in my childhood, that was very, very hot because the Bond films had just come out and were huge, huge international successes. And then we had the, you know, the Man from U.N.C.L.E. and a number of spy shows on TV. But my favorite TV show was a show called The Wild Wild West, which Bond and West. And so that was, as a kid, that was my favorite show. And years later, the star, Robert Conrad, and I became friends, and we're close friends for a number of years. And so I got to, we'd have lunch once a week, and I'd always get to ask questions about the show. Movies now, I'm not a superhero fan. I don't know. I miss things that are a little more down to earth. I like clever scripts. I like movies that make you think a little bit.
Yeah, we're not big superhero fans here on our show either. We do watch the superhero movies just so we can discuss them, but we're more into horror films and not just
and Vicky
you know,
is and, the sci-fi nut.
Yeah, she
well,
is the sci-fi.
More science fiction.
Yeah.
I was a huge fan of the Hammer films.
Sixties
and seventies and eighties. I was a very big fan of those films.
And I'm a big fan of the drive-in culture, which is how I really know your name. And I've had to fight throughout the years once people start seeing, looking at a drive-in movie, go, oh, that's Grindhouse. No, it's not. It was a drive-in movie.
Quote-unquote exploitation. And I was also a fan of the black exploitation movies in the 70s. So it was a great thrill. I got hired to direct a series that starred Richard Roundtree, who was Shaft, the original Shaft movies. And
nice.
So that was a big thrill for me to get to work with Richard.
Yeah.
I've always heard he was good and easy to work with.
Yeah, he was. He was very easy to work with. He was serious about, you know, about what he did. And but yeah, he was a good guy to work with.
Now,
go ahead, Nate.
Oh no, go ahead. No, ask a question
about
Richard Roundtree.
No,
because
just ask your
question.
I was just going to make observation.
My question was about lunch. Your question
was
probably
Richard Roundtree was a big star until he put out Man Friday, his reinterpretation of Robinson Crusoe, which he starred with Peter O'Toole in, and that killed any action cred he had with the black community. Put it in the night.
I have a funny story. When they made the reboot of Shaft with Samuel L. Jackson, Jackson said, had an edict that there would be no writers on the movie. And what Jackson probably didn't realize was that the character Shaft was created by Ernest Tiedemann, who was a white guy. And I ended up working with Ernest Tiedemann. Ernest Tiedemann wrote Shaft, and he wrote The French Connection. I think he won the Academy Award for The French Connection. But
I believe so.
But
yeah.
Ernest Tiedemann was not a black writer.
No, I wish that Roundtree could have gotten the Shaft movie that he wanted to do, but they made him do Shaft in Africa instead. He wanted to do an adaptation of Tiedemann's book, Shaft Among the Jews.
How would that have been any better than Shaft in Africa? It still would have been just
terrible.
If
you've read the book, it's great. Because the book basically portrays Shaft as the racist guy who goes among the Jews. And it has this one scene that's great. It's like Shaft looks at the old Jewish guy and says, "You don't understand what it's like to be imprisoned for like 100 years and forced to work." And then the Jewish guy shows him his concentration tramp tattoo and says, "Oh, really, do I?"
Yeah, I guess there's room for everyone to learn.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that as being a good scene. I can see that. You know who should direct it, though? Because I'm contractually obligated to mention every episode, Quentin Tarantino.
He'd probably spend.
I do have a question about Richard Roundtree.
Go ahead.
And I just want to know if he dressed as sharp on, you know, out as a regular person as he did in every single movie I ever saw him in, because I love the way that he's always dressed. And, you know, it's like, is that his style or is that Hollywood style? What did he wear, t-shirts and jeans out there in the real world? Because
he is
just a beautiful man with a beautiful sense of style, I swear.
He, on the show that I did, he always wore his own wardrobe. It was his real wardrobe. And
he
arrived at work every morning looking like that. The only thing was he said, "I've got it. deal with the lint in my hair, because he had a little bit of white hair popping up here and there. And
oh,
he would
yeah.
go to make, he would touch that up. But other than that, he always looked stylish.
Well, that's awesome yeah. to know, because he, in my mind, if I was like going to pick some of my favorite actors who were dressed just, you know, the best dressed, he'd be up there from top five. And so, yeah, wow, that's great to know.
And I love how when he's in the movies, he wore the black leather, the jeans and T-shirt, like Vicky said. But then when they did the TV movies, he upgraded in the three-piece suit.
Yeah.
but to Vicky's point, the thing is that, you know, an actor that would be normally wear jeans and a T-shirt is not going to, even if you give that actor the same clothing, they're not going to know how to wear it the same way.
That's true. You
have to have a kinship with that wardrobe to make it work.
True. In our movie, we're making our actors wear their own clothing too. We tell them what the scene needs and how they should dress, and they have to go through their own wardrobe and find it. It's just because we're low budget, you know.
Well, I mean,
but
that,
it works out.
That,
it works
that,
out. They
that's a lot of movies,
you know,
and
yeah.
I did a movie years ago with George Kennedy, who was a fairly big star at the time.
Right,
and he
I
brought
love him.
Every bit of clothing he owned from L.A. He emptied his closets and brought trunk after trunk of clothing because people, you know, if there's not a reason to wear a different wardrobe, they're often more comfortable in something they wear every day.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, that's a great, that's exactly what our main, our lead actor, our lead male actor, he brought his entire wardrobe. So he and our director went through all his clothes and said, yep, this one and this one and this one. And it was so
yeah.
wonderful. It was just awesome. I'm going to tell him the George Kennedy story.
Yeah, you know, I mean, often you need to have doubles, which in that case, it doesn't work. If you're
right.
making an action movie, you're going to end up wardrobing everybody in the movie. But,
yeah.
you know, if it's dialogue, you're probably going to be fine with their wardrobe.
Yeah.
There's a funny, I don't know if you guys watch Curb Your Enthusiasm, but there's a funny episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm where Larry David is filming a Martin Scorsese film, and he has a wardrobe, a jacket from the wardrobe, and he loses it, and he spends the entire episode trying to find a replacement for it. And when he finally gets back to the set, the wardrobe director says, oh yeah, no, I have another version. You know, I have another one, you know, so, as Vicky and Steven well know, I have a large wardrobe of,
my goodness.
Eccentric outfits over here. I told you, Vicky, you haven't even begun to see my wig collection.
True,
you've
I've only seen what, half a dozen?
You've only seen one of the... Yeah, I've got wigs for days, baby. I got wigs for days. So while we've got a guest here tonight for our 600th episode, let's ask some more questions. You know, we're just trying to talk about different stuff here. So what do you care for when it comes to music?
I God, I'm trying to think. Nothing. I'm not a. I've gotten tired of music, I guess. Take a trip in the car, any lengthy trip, I'm probably listening to an audio book or talk radio of some kind, because all the music that I grew up with, I've heard a million times now, and I don't really keep up with much of what's new. So
that happens to everybody.
Yep.
It's like my favorite Doonesbury commercial where cartoon, it was in the 80s, where it has him rocking out and he says, "Hey, do you think you're rocking out listening to this? Well, guess what? This is the oldies station. You're officially old now." And then it has him fall to the ground like, "No."
Well, I have my iTunes playlist, and I just add over the years, and they're incredibly long now. And I reach the point where I'm, even if it's something sort of that maybe years ago I wouldn't have liked someone to know that I liked it, I just put it on now because it's I really don't care anymore. But music to be in the background. If I'm going to be in a car for a number of hours, I want something more engaging than just listening to music.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't care for much modern music, but my wife and I are, we collect vinyl. We actually have 4 turntables in our house, so we can listen to vinyl in any room in the house. But otherwise, we don't listen to any real modern music. We just buy, a lot of records. But we do have a thing that we do that's really fun. We have a playlist on Spotify called Just Woke Up Like This. You know how you wake up in the morning and you have a song stuck in your head? Whenever happens to us, we add it to our Spotify playlist called Just Woke Up Like This. And it's an hilarious playlist, I'll tell you that much.
As frequent as a song, I get bits of background music from movies stuck in my head, and I can't guess what movie they came from, but I remember the piece of background music very vividly.
Worth, it was nice having you on, and people, if you really want to get something good, get the Blu-ray that he worked on of Axe. And I think, doesn't the Blu-ray come with a double feature of his other film, Kidnapped, Co-Ed?
Yeah, it might. And there's some documentaries on there. We went back to, and there aren't many left, but we tried to go back to the original filming locations from 1973. And it's pretty entertaining if you like that sort of movie.
Well, Kidnap Co-Ed, like Axe, goes to places you really don't expect a movie like that to go. Because the setup is just basically man kidnaps woman and woman falls in love with him.
None of us had a clue what it was about. We knew there was a kidnap, but a lot of the little bits in the movie were just made up at the time. And we go, where does this come from? Like, it would be the bad guy or the kidnapper checks into a hotel, and Rick would make a whole deal out of the desk clerk, sticking something in his ear. So a lot of it was made up, and we just knew what the movie was about after a point.
Yeah, and go ahead.
Who's talking?
You, Nate.
I wasn't, talking. It wasn't me either.
Steven, I was going to say, doesn't a man kidnaps woman and woman falls in love with him and marries him? Isn't that how your marriage started?
No.
The axe and the kidnapper movie was at one point Rick, the director, because they both starred the same actor, and they were both short movies. He had the idea to edit them together, and he made it into a film called Bloody Brothers, where he explained that they were two brothers that were like separated at birth, but they both went on a crime spree unbeknownst to each other about 40 miles from each other. And he edited the two movies together.
If that's on the Blu-ray, I'm going to go order it tonight because that just sounds awesome.
Yeah, I want to see that flick. I want to see that flick. I'm ready for it, baby. Let's do it.
But yeah, a movie where you can tell that the director is just going to go off on any weird tangent he wants is more interesting than just the A to B to C to D movie. And that's what makes Axe and Kidnap Coed so watchable.
And
there wasn't much of a
script.
You're
the guest. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think on both of those movies, I'm going to say the scripts weren't much longer than 40 pages or so.
I really love low-budget movies that are like regional, like an old movie like Teenage Strangler or something, where it's just like, you know, some random dude in Kentucky decides that he's gonna make a movie, you know. Like, I love stuff like that. I really love that kind of like underground cinema. That for me, that's a real favorite.
Yeah.
You know. Or like we were talking about earlier, like the Florida films that just kind of seemed to have sprung out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden we've got this weird Florida movie.
You might want to check out, it's a really terrible movie, but the first movie I ever worked on was, you can find it now, called Dr. Gore.
I got that.
And,
no,
Patterson.
Vicky has a copy of it.
No, that's me, Steve.
I do not have a copy of that.
I do. DVD of it as Dr. Gore. It comes with J.G. Patterson's Dr. Gore and his other film, The Electric Chair.
Yeah, I worked on both those movies. I actually get shot in the electric chair. I'm courtroom scene, and somebody goes nuts, and I'm in the jury, and I get shot and killed.
Nice.
But, yeah, Dr. Gore is insane, and I think it's funny that the print that Something Weird has the opening dedication from H.G. Lewis on it.
Yeah. Pat Patterson had worked on some of Herschel Gordon Lewis's movies in Florida, and came back to North Carolina, and I guess decided he could do the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and I have a J.G. Patterson story for you, Worth, before you go. It was at a bar, and William Gaffey was filming a Whiskey Mountain. He told us when he's on the air, and he called Patterson Booger. And he said they were in a bar, and these two locals were messing with him. And they started trying to pick a fight, and then Gaffey looked over at me and said, "Hold Booger back. Hold Booger back."
Okay.
And these guys kept messing. Okay.
That was not the same guy.
Okay.
Because I've seen that, and I was confused for years. But
yeah.
J.G. Patterson was a very small guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he was probably 5'5 or 5'6. Gaffey. I think the thing was Herschel Gordon Lewis made a movie, Whiskey Mountain or something, and
Moonshine Mountain.
Confusion.
Yeah, Moonshine. Yep.
Yeah, there's some confusion because I would see that for years, and I'd go, yeah, I knew Pat Patterson during that time, and he's can't be the same guy. I think pretty much if your last name is Patterson, your nickname is going to be Pat.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
mm-hmm.
That's just how it is. Like, I've read stories on the Something Weird documentary, he tried to say that Earl Owensby was a drive-in distributor in the Carolinas who was the creator of the term getting softcore dirty porn movies and then putting Swedish before every one of them.
Well, a couple of things wrong with that. Earl Owensby had a tool company that sold pneumatic tools. And the other thing is Earl was taught Sunday school. So there was never, I mean, the movies were practically G-rated for a long time. There was never any involvement with porn. So
I know. It was just one of those things that I heard. I'm like, what? What the heck is he talking about?
Yeah, he was confused somewhere.
Yeah. Well, Earl is one of those guys that not much have been written on him because there really hasn't been that much information about him out there.
Well, there was a lot at the time. I mean, there were a lot of magazine profiles. 60 Minutes did a story there, but so there was a lot done, but it was in the late 70s, early 80s. So it's just not a lot of that is floating out there anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I'm really glad that we got to have you on the show. You know, we're big fans. We are movie nerds, and we pay attention to things like this. So we're really happy that we got to have you on the show, especially for our 600th episode.
This is an honor. And thank you for being on. And if you talk to Earl, tell him that we said thank you for his movies, and he needs to get them out on DVD so we can watch them.
Well, they're trying to keep it.
Yeah.
Everett really is. Okay, take care, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for being on the show.
Okay, before we get to the giveaway, there was something, a big announcement, something about November. November, November, what is so special about November? I'm just going to shut up. Do you, Vicki and Nate, have anything to say about November?
I can't wait for the cold weather.
Yes. No, we don't have anything to say about November, but...
maybe October.
But yes, October.
I think.
Yes,
I thought that's what I was told a few hours ago.
Yes. So on October 3rd, Vicki and I are going to launch a podcast of our own where we will be talking about everything from movies to music to politics and healthcare. I'll still be here with Steven on Wednesday nights, and Vicki and I will be doing our show on Sunday nights. So, yeah, we'll keep you updated to let you know where and when you can listen to
and,
our new show.
I will download his show and upload it here to KSDAD so fans of Vicki and Nate could hear it here, too.
Perfect. That sounds delicious.
Okay.
Yeah, look at this. 600 episodes. Nate's being very creative. And Vicki's making a movie. We've gone a long way from the girl who I had to get on the show because she was complaining about us talking about the most disturbing film, saying that, you know, that's about a women's perspective. You don't understand. I'm like, yeah, I'm either going to hear complaining or get her on the air.
Oh, my God. You remember that?
Yes.
The first show that we ever did was me and you talking about
the most disturbing was the first one that you were on, but the first thing that me and you did together was the stuff that we talk about on Our Massive. He was the first one to really give me a shot that, besides the little reviews that I was writing on Facebook, he just showed up. He's like, hey, you want to do something together? I'm like, okay.
Yeah, we did our Joe Dorowski podcast, but that was after we had already started working on the magazine. Yeah. Yeah, we were doing the stuff on the magazine. E-magazine, yeah.
Or as the cool kids called it back then, an e-zine.
E-zine.
That was just another way for people to say, oh, I don't blog. I make an e-zine.
We e-zined it. That was fun. And here we are. Now, how long ago do you think that was? I smoke a lot of marijuana, so I don't have any short-term memory.
2010 to 2012.
Yeah, because it was back when I still lived in Bangor. Yeah. That was when Abby and I still lived in Bangor. So, yeah, I'm thinking 2010. So I'm thinking what? We've done 20, what?
Yeah,
10,
we've
done a lot of it. I'm not good at math.
And Vicki has done over possibly 100 Vicki Loves Sci-Fi. I'm going to have to count that out.
Yeah.
There was a time when I
was doing it twice a month, and that was a long time ago.
That's back
before my
your
job
drove you insane, literally.
Mm. Exactly. Before, like, next week work starts. What? It's only the beginning of August. We used to have more time off, yeah, and it wasn't as crazy as it is now. So, yeah, I used to do a lot more podcasts than I do now, a lot more, but things are changing.
Yeah.
Well, Vicki and I are going to start our new podcast on October 3rd, and Stephen will obviously be a frequent guest. So I hope everyone will tune in and listen to that.
Probably not in October, because I got all the Halloween shenanigans I always do on October. And hopefully this year we can get Vicki to read a story for the live reading show. Nate's always... That's really where you've really been a part of it, because you usually do a story. You usually, before we did this, you've always, like, do it reading a story for that.
Yeah, we always did that in October. We can obviously do that again this year. That's a fun tradition. Each of us reading a scary story. I love that. Yeah. That's a good one.
I usually record mine, because that's usually when I'm so burnt out from work and I don't have any time. It's the worst. October used to be my favorite month, my whole life. October, favorite month, you know, Halloween, favorite holiday. All I can think of now as a teacher is I can't wait till after Halloween, because I got a Thanksgiving break coming up. Stuff like that screws with your head, and you just don't want to do it anymore. I understand totally. Yeah,
burnout is one of the worst things that can happen to anybody when it comes to your job or anything.
Anything, yeah, exactly. But
it's that weird.
Go ahead.
Oh no, I was just gonna say it's that weird thing with my job where I work days and I get nights, weekends, and holidays off. But then it's like there's that. Always that weird thing where you get like Memorial Day or Labor Day or the 4th of July off. But the way it works, since I work for the federal government, if you don't work the day before or after a holiday, you don't get the holiday pay. Is that what it's like working as a teacher, Vicki?
No, God, no. I wish. I used to work for the IRS, so I know what you're talking about. I remember I had to go into work on Easter Sunday, because as far as the federal government is concerned, Easter isn't a holiday. And I remember that really well. But no, being in education, they expect you to bring home tons of work, because they don't give you time to grade at school anymore. What they do is they take up all your time at school with useless, endless dribble and meetings. Constantly you're going from here to there. If you're not in the classroom with students, then you're going to go listen to some idiot talk the same thing that they talked last year about, I don't know, education stuff, okay?
Yeah.
It's not so much like that. I'm looking forward to like a week off, because I need to sleep for 3 days, because I don't get to sleep from next week when I start till the end of October. I don't sleep. And so, it's totally, they want it that way.
Yeah.
That's
it's
the
like
worst
this,
part about it.
Nate. Okay. Today we're going to have the staff meeting. Tomorrow we're going to have the post-staff meeting. And the day after that, we're going to have you come here and workshop on ideas for our next staff meeting.
Exactly.
I feel personally attacked by that.
You know, here's the thing. They make us go to those workshops. Do you know anything about math? Well, your students are studying math. Maybe you should know a little more about math. So take a math workshop. And I'm an English teacher. And I'm like, what the you-know-what? Fuck!
Late dad died, Vicki, and go ahead, Nate.
Oh, I was just going to comment on Vicky saying that. So the last staff meeting that we had, everyone had to put a sticker on their forehead that was a different color. And you didn't know what color your sticker was, but you had to find everyone else that had the same color sticker as you. My boss pulled his phone out and took a picture of his forehead and saw that he had a yellow sticker and just went around and found everyone else with a yellow sticker.
Oh, man. But my dad, before he retired early because of his heart attack and he started getting a little bit of mental dementia, was a mechanics teacher. But to get a raise every year, he had to go back to college to get degrees in English, in math, in science, because that's what teachers do.
I know, it's ridiculous. You know, they hired me to teach English, and yet I have to go to sometimes they're like 2-day workshops on statistics. Not statistics like the class, but trying to figure out the statistical average of why my students are failing. Some kind of BS like that. I'll tell you why they're failing. Because they don't want to do the work. Okay? I don't need to go to a two-day workshop to know what's wrong with this kid's grades, all right? They think of the most ridiculous thing so that they can pay these people that don't want to be teachers anymore to turn around and try to teach teachers stuff we already know. I don't know. It's ridiculous.
I'll tell you what irritates me the most. I have a degree in English with a minor in philosophy, but to earn those two degrees.
Oh my God.
Did Vicky just hang up? Oh God.
No.
But to earn those two degrees, I also had to take a lot of mathematics and science courses when I went to college. Now, the same college that I graduated from, if you want an English degree, all you got to do is take English classes. No math, no science. You don't got to worry about that stuff anymore. And I'm really? Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Expensive now for the young people to get that well-rounded education. We're the last literate generation. The other ones coming up, they're not literate. They just know one tunnel vision part of the world, and that's their subject.
Right.
Rote memorization.
No, I wish we went back to rote memorization. The kids wouldn't be dumb. If we went back to the boring stuff of school instead of just trying to entertain everybody, the kids wouldn't be dumb anymore. They'd be smart like us. But no, we must entertain them now. So we entertain them.
Glorified babysitters until they're 18, and then they kick them out in the world without knowing which way is up.
Totally. Totally. I just said that to someone today.
Personally, I think we need to learn new math and critical race theory. That's just my point. This is Brad Bradley Whitford with a talk for the day.
Critical race theory, but there's that new math. Oh my God! Oh my God! I sit down with my granddaughter, who's going into second grade right now, but when she was in kindergarten, she brought home this book, and at the back of the book it had math, and it said 2 + 2 = here, let's look at it in a different way. And they take these apples and they start showing all these different scenarios to a kid that doesn't even know that 2 + 2 = 4, right? You got to teach them that before you teach them all these other weird ways of coming up with the number 4 for the answer. But, oh, no, they skip the critical thing. They skip the lesson that needs to be learned in favor of these theories that only freaking astrophysicists, excuse me, Kevin, I didn't mean that like that, only astrophysicists are going to use. So, so yeah,
they don't
I'm so looking forward to school.
They don't even teach you the difference between apples and oranges before they start asking you math questions. Come on. What's going on here?
If they would just use granola bars, everyone knows what granola bars are, right?
But granola bars come two to a package, so you got to be careful about that because that's going to make the math a little weak. make the math a little crazy.
Yeah. And before I get to details about the giveaway, I'm looking over here at Princess.
Yeah, we got a giveaway.
It's annoying me. I've had her as long as pretty much as long as I've been doing the show. And one of my favorite Princess moment, you was not Nate, but Vicky was. It was like one night and 1 hour into the show, we were talking, and then all of a sudden, Vicky and our other co-host who was there heard this horrible clang and me going, oh, God dang, and then said, I'll be back. And it turned out that Miss Princess had grabbed her water bowl, which was empty, and threw it and hit me right in the head. You remember that, Vicky?
I do remember that. Well, like what happened to Steven. What's wrong?
Keep your dog's water bowl filled, you moron.
I learned that the hard way. She's like, yes, I will teach you the hard way.
The other morning I woke up and I oftentimes suffer from panic attacks, and that generally manifests itself in like cold sweat. And I had come into my my.
And his power or his microphone dropped out again. But until he gets back, let's talk about the giveaway. I am giving away, as the honor for this, the Tapito Man pop. Let's see here. Gore Grind Mutilations from Gorefilth, one of my other co-hosts I've done shows with, and Hello Kitty, Spaceman Kitty. That's because Vicky's in the sci-fi, so we got to have the rocket scientist there. Right, Vicky? Yeah.
That's right.
And also for Vicky, I'm giving away my copy of the tie-in novel of Galaxy Quest.
The tie-in novel? What's that?
The tie-in novel that came out with the movie.
Oh, how about that? I didn't even know there was one.
Yeah.
Why is it that every time I try to tell you guys a long story, my computer kicks me off?
I don't know. You've had the worst luck tonight, man, with your power and everything.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah, it's been horrible. But, hey, 600, woo!
Yeah, and... I would have a Quentin Tarantino thing to give away in Nate, but I don't have anything that's spare in any of the pops of his besides the ones I got for Hateful Eight. Well, they'll run you $50 at the cheapest. Right, Nate?
Yeah. my wife has a box of 72 kazoos that she said we can donate to the giveaway tonight.
72 kazoos for the township.
72 kazoos.
Definitely a song.
Yeah.
There's a song there.
Yeah, from the music, man. Instead of 72 trombones, we got 72 kazoos.
Yeah, it was. This is for real. I have a box of 72 kazoos that I bought for $10 just as a gag for my friend Lawton, because Abby and I have been working on our new album and we've been recording a bunch of ukulele songs. My friend Lawton is a musician, so I sent him some of our demos. I posted some of them on Facebook as well. And Lawton, 3 days later, Lawton says, "Oh, I didn't listen to your demo because I thought it said ukuleles." He said, "I thought it said kazoos, not ukuleles, so I didn't want to listen to it." So I said, oh, cool. But then he was,
"Oh, is going to be for the contest three trivia questions, and to enter it, email Stephen 568@AOL.com and make sure to put in the title contest entry. And if you get the questions right, you will be put in for a drawing for the winner. And here is the first question, and there's going to be three, and here it's the first. The first one is, what novel was based on, the title was taken from the author listening to John Lennon's Instant Karma? And here's the second one, and it's a twist because it's going to be hard. One, what is Nate's favorite Quentin Tarantino movie? And two, what Jess Franco movie is referenced in said movie?
Huh. Mm.
Yeah.
You really worked that one. You really worked that one out, didn't you, brother?
Yeah. And the third question is for sci-fi. Okay. What movie, this is a sci-fi movie, was remade four times, once in the 50s. Well, it was made in the 50s first, then a sequel/remake was made in the 70s starring Donald Sutherland, and then it was done in the 90s as a remake with Meg Tilly, and then it was done in the 00s as a remake with Kidman. And the second part to that question is, what famous sci-fi show was one of the stars of the 79 remake of said movie, which you're going to have to answer a part of?
Say that again?
The 79 remake of this movie that's the answer, what... One of the stars was part of a famous sci-fi series. What was it?
Ah, okay.
Boy, Stephen really does not want to give away these prizes, does he?
These
are like
the
hardest.
To that.
Yeah.
I know the answer to question number two as well, but that doesn't mean I'm going to win the prizes.
Yeah. And I'll post it on Facebook, but put the answers in and get to Stephen08-0568@AOL.com. And just all through the years, thank you to every one of my guests who's been on the show. Thank you to the original KSADAD. Definitely thank you to Vicky, Nate, Gore Freak, Frederick, who will definitely have an episode next week for Friday the 13th. The guys from Central Cinema, who is the best theater in Knoxville. And the guys from the drive-in drive-in Monsterama, who we will be doing an episode next month with them close to their Jalo Fest this year. And to all of the guests I've had, thank you. This show has been better because of you. And thank you, Vicky, for knowing a crap load about sci-fi, more than I do. You're like the go-to sci-fi, TV, movie, books.
Well, some people laugh at me for that, but I'm comfortable. No, Stephen, thank you for letting me just geek out on podcast, having my own show, and doing as much sci-fi and science as I want to do. It's just a pleasure, and it's been so much fun over the years. You know, I wouldn't be doing any of this if it wasn't for you. So,
yeah,
thank you
so
much.
And the funny Vicky moment is basically one episode that me and her had with old host and one of her guests. It was never published because of this incident. The show's audio melted, Nate. And I'm not kidding. It was like 1 second we were talking and then everything was Yeah, it was like a record that, you know, it was like, what the heck?
It was the most horrible thing that ever happened. And that person never spoke to me again. It wasn't my fault. It wasn't our fault at all.
Yeah.
It was the programming. It was that. It was nobody's fault. Oh, God. It was
yeah.
Funny now.
No, but yeah. No, we have had a really good run. I mean, the three of us have built an amazing empire with our individual podcasts and teaming up together, and 600 shows over the past few years is pretty amazing. So I'm looking forward to 600 more between the three of us. So let's just keep on running with it, you know.
And how do you do it, folks? Yeah. All the people have been doing podcasts. Well, find out what you know and love to talk about it. And then find two other people that know stuff that you don't. Otherwise, it's going to get stale very, very quickly.
And if you want to do a podcast with Stephen, it's not hard to find things that he doesn't know about.
Well, I'm smart enough. A smart man knows what he doesn't know, not what he knows.
Exactly. That's a
true.
Good quote.
True.
And thank you to Nate for giving me my first chance. I wouldn't have written for the magazine. I wouldn't even have done this without you giving me that first chance and giving me the confidence that, hey, I can do something besides just piddly-piddly on Facebook.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun with the website, and then we just parlayed it into this podcast, which has been amazing. I've had so much fun, man. So many years, so many guests, so many topics. Like, this has been a great ride, man. It's been a great ride.
Yeah. And if you get someone like Vicky who knows sci-fi and all that, let them do their own thing. Don't try to make them to conform to what you think they should do. It'll be a lot better that way. Don't make people conform. Just let them be themselves.
Yeah, and that's also true about your guests, too. You can ask them leading questions. But if they don't answer it the way you want, then just let it be. Just, you know, don't try to pigeonhole your guests either. You know, they get upset with that. So don't make your guests upset, because here's the one thing I learned way back when I was doing interviews for my newspaper, for the newspaper I used to run here in town. People love to talk, and they love to talk about themselves and their projects and the things that they have done. Kind to your guests. Ask them leading questions or open-ended questions, and be happy for everything they ever tell you. You'll be a happy podcaster.
Yeah. And I have to say, if I was going to pick the worst show we ever did, it would be Tessa Dick, and it's in the archives. Never, ever get someone on the show as a guest, and Vicky was there, be glad you weren't, Nate, that pretty much is on strong LSD and mushrooms at the same time, because they will...
The funny thing was, I was talking to Vicky about this earlier today, and I was like, I'm on mushrooms right now. But, you know, like, and you and I have talked about this before. Some people can handle their shit. Some people can't. I think I conducted myself professionally throughout this podcast, despite the fact that I am currently tripping on mushrooms.
Well,
so, you know,
a lot of people drink heavily during podcasts, you know, what they do.
But
she
spent the whole show talking about how the conspiratist and the man was after Philip K. Dick because of his writings.
Right.
Yeah.
The co-host was into that. The other co-host was feeding that whole thing the whole time.
I was not on that podcast, but I have listened to it. And, yeah, she was out of her mind, man. I don't know what was going on with that.
And if I was going to pick the best guest, it would probably – the one with the best guest I've had with Vicky was the Boggy Creek episode. Her and the daughter of the guy who directed that got along like they knew each other for like a million freaking years.
Right.
I didn't have to say anything because they were just talking like old friends like at a class reunion.
It was a really good show. And it was like we'd been friends forever. That was a click. That was smooth and fun.
Well, no one wants to talk about it openly, but Vicky is from Boggy Creek. She grew up there. So don't let her pretend like some new girl just dumped into her life. No.
No,
Vicky
she's
grew up
always
in Boggy
been
Creek.
A Cali girl. Cali and Arizona, right?
Yes, Arizona. Yes, you're right.
When I was driving home from my doctor's appointment today, there was a sign when I came, there's a small town here that's kind of like a hipster town between my doctor's office and where I live. And there was a sign that said, "Caution, Bigfoot crossing." I was like, all right. I guess I'll be careful. I don't know. But yeah.
I don't know. I could live near people like that. I could deal with that. That's much better than.
Oh yeah, no, it's a cool little town. It's a cool little hipster town. But like I said, it's between like where my doctor's office is and where I actually live. It's just a cool little hipster town. But I just thought it was hilarious. I came driving down around the corner.
Yeah.
Oh, caution, Bigfoot crossing.
It's totally cool. Totally.
Oh shit. Yeah. Well, all right, guys. I got to go to bed. Happy 600.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you guys for 600, and thank everyone who's listened to the show throughout the year.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have
so appreciate our listeners.
Yes, we have had a great fan base, and we have had a lot of great guests. This has been a lot of fun, and like I said, let's go for 600 more, you know?
Amen.
Do it.
I agree.
All right.
And with that,
I'll talk to you guys
later. Questions will be posted on Facebook with the rules. Thank you again, you all again. And as always, as we leave these shows, good night, sweetheart. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night, sweetheart. When it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart. When it's time to go.
I hate to leave you, but I really must.
Good night, sweetheart. Good night.
Good night, sweetheart. When it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart. When it's time to go. I hate to leave you. I really must say. Oh, good night, sweetheart. Good night. Well, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Baby, I just can't get right. Well, I hate to leave you, baby. Don't mean maybe, because I love you so. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. I hate to leave you. I really must say, oh, good night, sweetheart. Good night, mother. Oh, and your father like it if I stay here too long. One kiss in the dark, and I'll be going. You know I hate to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. Good night, sweetheart. Well, it's time to go. I hate to leave you. I really must say, oh, good night, sweetheart. Good night.
Good night, everybody. See you in the next 600. Night.